thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Face to Face.
My pleasure.
News of your appointment as director of a national intelligence stirred mixed emotions among the American political establishment. And initially, you weren't sure if you wanted to take the position or not. What made you decide to accept Admiral Dennis Blair's offer to lead the National Intelligence Council at that time, initially?
Well, it's true. I didn't particularly want to go back into public service. I had given 30 years of my life to the government and was frankly enjoying the freedom to speak out and do what I wanted and even make some money that came with being in the private sector. But in the end, Admiral Blair convinced me that I had a unique combination of things to give to the job, broad experience on every continent in the world, and a reputation for speaking my mind quite honestly and directly, regardless of the political fallout. And what he wanted and I wanted was to improve the quality of U.S. intelligence and to enhance its credibility. So that was, in the end, I suppose I couldn't resist the call to serve my country one more time.
Right. Did it bother you that President Barack Obama remained silent when you were criticized for this position? Did you expect more of this administration and its quote-unquote policies of change?
Well, I think I was obviously disappointed that I didn't have support from the White House, but as I understand the way this administration works, I really shouldn't have been surprised. Appointments in this administration are made on quite a decentralized basis. The president is a very competent manager, and good managers delegate staffing decisions to their subordinates. So I think too much has been read into this. The reason I was selected was not to signal a policy change of any kind in any region of the world, the Middle East or anywhere else, but, as I said, to improve the credibility and the quality of our intelligence output. And I was made into a symbol of a policy change by my detractors, because they projected some sort of fantasy of my going in with a strong anti-Israel agenda. Mm-hmm. Nothing could have been farther from my intention.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is I don't think the decision not to back me was a political signal of any kind. It simply reflects the reality of this administration.
Right. You say that you don't have an anti-Israeli agenda, but you have been termed as calling the Israeli lobby in the United States as the Likud lobby, and perhaps that is detracting American national interests, this strong lobby that we see inside Washington.
Yes, I think there is a small group, a relatively small group in the American Jewish community, which is strongly aligned with Likud or even with Avigdor Lieberman and the Israel Beitenu movement in Israel, and which uses really quite despicable tactics of character assassination and political intimidation to get its way in American politics. I don't think this represents the majority of American Jews, and it certainly doesn't represent the majority of the American people. In fact, one of the most heartening elements in this whole experience was the many expressions of support I had from Jewish friends, and indeed many American Jews I had never met who thought that I was opening room for a debate that was long overdue and freeing them from a sort of oppression by these elements who sympathize with the most extreme political trends in Israel proper.
And why do you think that they singled you out and basically prevented you from taking this post? Why were they intimidated by a figure like you?
Well, I don't think they're working on behalf of a foreign government. They're working on behalf of a faction in a foreign country, mm-hmm. which is even worse. What is it that they objected to about me? Well, I am critical of Israeli policy. I believe Israel's policies are destructive to American interests and also to Israeli interests. I don't see how Israel can continue to survive in the long term as a state in the Middle East if it is not prepared to deal with respect and consideration with its Arab neighbors, especially the Palestinians. So I think it is not an act of hostility to Israel to be critical of it. It is an act of friendship. And the failure to observe that, to see that, to agree with that, is what I find most detestable about this particular group of people.
Right. And this quote-unquote particular group of people probably won't agree with you when you say that being critical of them is an act of friendship, because it seems that criticizing Israeli policies abroad are much easier than criticizing Israeli policies here in the United States, which is another country. And it's almost a taboo among Washington policymakers.
Well, it is very much a taboo, and it's been enforced by the kind of scurrilous tactics that were applied to me. The great irony, of course, is that Israelis themselves are far more critical and in much harsher terms of their government's policies than I've ever been. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange thing that Israelis can criticize these things, but somehow Americans are not allowed to.
Why?
Well, I think the interest of this little group on the right wing of the Israel lobby is to ensure that there is no debate, that Israel receives blanket support for whatever it does, and that it is not subject to criticism, that it is protected from the majority of the international community's anger over its actions. The United States repeatedly exercises vetoes in the United Nations Security Council to prevent criticism of Israel. And all of this is seen by this group as somehow helpful to Israel. I think it is actually very destructive and unhelpful to Israel, because what it does is it prevents Israel from having to make the sorts of choices that it must make if it is to survive as a state in the Middle East.
Do you think that this is harming America's image abroad in any way?
Well, the critics, my critics, were themselves Americans, but they're Americans with what George Washington called a passionate attachment for a foreign country. He argued that such passionate attachments were destructive and should be avoided. I agree with him. So, yes, I believe that considerable damage has been done to the United States and our image and our interests by an unreasoning support of whatever it is that is decided in Israel. And I believe the resulting atmosphere in the Arab world and indeed the broader Muslim world is conducive to the recruitment of terrorists who attack us and to hostility to American interests and efforts to undermine those interests in the broad swath of the Dar al-Islam.
You initially, at the beginning of the interview, said that you wanted to lead the National Intelligence Council because you wanted to bring change to this council, to this organization, and it was your opportunity to do that. What kind of change would you have brought, and what kind of change does this council need at this point in time?
Well, there have been grave issues with both the quality and the credibility of intelligence in recent years. Not only was there the infamous slicing, dicing, and stir-frying of intelligence that went on in preparation for the invasion of Iraq, but there have been other controversies and the political abuse of intelligence. In many ways, it has come to seem that people in Washington see intelligence as ammunition for political argument or polemics rather than as a guide to policymaking. So the object, what I wanted to do, was to restore realism and objectivity to the process, not by imposing my own views, which may be wrong, but by asking hard questions. before people release a conclusion, I would like to know, why is it that you say this? Is it because everybody says it, or is it because you have some evidence to back your saying it? Why do you come to the conclusion that you do, when your conclusion is at odds with those of others who have studied the same subject? And I would have liked to have opened up the process and built some checks and balances into it to protect it against politicization. The irony is, of course, that I was accused of intending myself to politicize it. Nothing could be farther from the truth.
Right. Your critics were basically saying that because you have very strong feelings regarding the Middle East and China and American policies towards these regions, you might not have the objectivity to really lead this council. What would you answer to those people?
I think what they were actually saying is that the only conclusions of intelligence analysis are those that are politically correct, and that if you're going to come up with conclusions that are politically unwelcome or inconvenient, we don't want to hear them. Mm-hmm. So to this I would say, if in fact the only acceptable outcome of analysis is conclusions that are stipulated before the analysis has even been done, why bother with the analysis at all? Mm-hmm. Why not just make a political statement and be done with it?
Mm-hmm. Is that what's been happening?
To some extent it has been. That is, there's been an element of sycophancy and tailoring intelligence to meet the preconceptions or the preferences of the consumer, rather than to reflect the underlying facts.
Let's talk about the current administration. Just recently, you wrote that this whole episode has for you cast doubt on the willingness of the Obama administration to, this is a direct quote, consider, let alone decide, what policies might best serve the interests of the United States rather than those of a lobby intent on enforcing the will and the interests of a foreign government. What does it take for the Obama administration to break free and move away from decisions like these?
Well, in the interest of accuracy, I think I said that this development, the requirement for me to withdraw, would raise doubts in many people's minds about the Obama administration's ability to make decisions. What does it take to reverse that? It takes actions. It takes decisions. Talk enough is not enough in itself. I think the administration is much too new and has barely begun its work to make any judgment whatsoever about what it may or may not be able to do in the Middle East. So far we've had two very encouraging initiatives from the president, both in the nature of softening up issues for later discussion. One was his decision to speak on Al Arabiya, and the other was his Nowruz message to the people of Iran and to the government of Iran, which he dignified with its official name. Mm-hmm. These things in themselves don't solve problems, but they indicate a desire to communicate, to listen, as well as to speak, and a willingness to try to understand the viewpoint of the other side. That's the basis of sound policy.
Right. His interview with Al Arabiya actually stirred a lot of fury in the Arab world, as you may know. The population, they were saying that that wasn't really an interview. It was a step, but don't actions usually speak more louder than words?
Well, in the end, as I said, there will have to be action for credibility to be restored. Mm-hmm. There's been much too much talk with no action. The classic example was the so-called Annapolis peace process at the end of the Bush administration, which was either a farce or a deception. I don't know which it was. I believe President Bush may actually have inhaled his own propaganda and believed that he was doing something. Mm-hmm. In the end, of course, it amounted to less than nothing.
Right. What about current President Barack Obama's Nowruz message to the Iranians? How would you view that? And what about the response that it got from Iranian officials?
Well, I think it was in the nature of a pre-negotiating step, and that both sides made it clear, he in his message and the Iranian government in its response, that pre-negotiation is not negotiation, that there are serious issues that need to be addressed between the two countries, that neither side is in a position to pick and choose its agenda. It will have to address the agendas of both parties. That's all very realistic, and it doesn't in itself solve anything, but it certainly makes it easier to move to a problem-solving mode.
Mm-hmm. What does it take for the betterment of ties between Iran and Washington, between Tehran and Washington?
Well, I think realistically, it takes, first of all, the abandonment of the monotonous and strident message that the previous administration repeatedly sent to Iran. I don't think it is useful to call people evil and say that you won't talk to them until they surrender, nor is it useful to threaten them with bombing and attack. All this does is harden attitudes and provide a justification for the very nuclear program you object to. President Obama has not repeated this litany. On the contrary, he's held out the possibility of broad discussions. Those discussions are not going to be easy. There are serious issues on both sides. I suppose on the Iranian side, people want to go back to the early 1950s and the overthrow of the democratically elected government and its replacement with the regime of the Shah. And there will be other issues that are of concern that are ancient and long past, but much remembered in Iran. On the United States side, there are also serious issues having to do with the way in which Iran has exercised its growing influence in the region, the relationship that it has with the enemies of Israel, who are, by our own decision, our enemies as well, there will be, of course, a serious need to address the question of security in the Gulf.
Right, and in the Persian Gulf. What about the Israeli lobby or the Likud lobby, or AIPAC? Are they going to stand in the way of the betterment of ties, do you think, between Tehran and Washington?
Well, I think this element that is the far right in Israel and its sympathizers here. See Iran as the only serious threat to Israel's existence. I think they're wrong about that. I think their own actions are the most serious threat to Israel's existence. And I don't believe that Iran intends to attack Israel, whatever it may say, for political effect. But the fact is that there is a danger that Israel will insist on its agenda. I don't think the Obama administration is interested in cooperating with that. That is already an advance over the previous administration.
Mm-hmm.
There are other questions with regard to the Israeli relationship with Iran. In the past, of course, because Iran is not Arab and lies behind the Arab world from the Israeli perspective, Iran and Israel had a very close relationship. I suppose if that sort of relationship were open to an Israeli government that had resolved the Palestinian issue, for example, they would seize on it with alacrity, and Iran and Israel would once again have good relations, notwithstanding the recent history.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that one should assume unrelenting hostility from either Israel or the Israel lobby here to an improvement in relations with Iran under some circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Under some conditions, with preconditions, right?
Well, under better conditions than the present.
Right.
As long as Israel does not express a willingness to approve and pursue a two-state solution which allows the Palestinians to live free of oppression under an occupation, then there will still be a great incentive for Iran to exploit the animosity that the suffering of the Palestinians causes. And there will be openings for Iran to extend its influence in a way that is injurious to Israel. If that issue were removed, I don't think Iran would have the same interest at all.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we're talking about the policy community and policymakers in the United States, and whichever path we take during our discussion, it goes back to Israel and the Israeli government. But let's shift from that and take a look at the policy community in the United States. Here, do you think that they're ready for a fresh start with Iran?
I think there's a broad consensus here that the past approach has failed, that we've been locked for 30 years in some sort of impasse, that Iran is too important a country to be ignored in the manner in which we have ignored it, that Iranian policies, including the nuclear program, raise serious issues which need to be discussed with Iran. So I think there is something approaching a consensus about the need to engage with Iran. Whether in the end that means that we can reach some common understanding with Tehran, I don't know.
The NIC is in the process of working on its latest NIE on Iran. What can you tell us about this report?
Well, I'm not there, so I can't tell you anything about it. Except you've
been on the on the forefront of these reports back in 2006, one of the most important decision-making processes of the United States was the NIE report back then. So,
well, I would say with regard to the national intelligence estimates on Iran that they remain controversial, and it has been said that one of the reasons my appointment was blocked was the fear that I might not come up with the politically correct conclusion that Iran is an irremediable threat to Israel and the United States. What conclusion I might have come up with if I had actually been on the job, I don't know, because I haven't seen the material that the intelligence community is examining. All I can say is that I hope that the intelligence community once again stands its ground and reports its own conclusions and not those that are politically convenient for the Likud lobby or any other faction in American politics.
Right. Back in 2006, the NIE stirred a lot of controversy regarding Iran here in the United States, and some analysts would say that even the Bush administration was caught by surprise back then?
Oh, I think that the Bush administration indeed was very taken aback by the conclusion that Iran had suspended or possibly abandoned the nuclear weapons program while it was continuing to develop other elements of a nuclear program. I think that was very politically inconvenient for an administration which had been seeming to steel itself to attack Iran. It rather pulled the plug on that whole thing. So the intelligence community, I think, demonstrated in that case that it was prepared to stand up and to deliver a conclusion without regard to the political fallout that that conclusion might generate.
Right. What about the appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State? Do you see, considering her past comments made regarding the Middle East and her ideas of the region as a whole, do you see a fresh start on that part when it comes to Middle Eastern issues?
Well, there is, of course, a question which has been raised less about Hillary Clinton, who is a very adaptable politician and very pragmatic, than about Dennis Ross and his role. And the question is, can the same old faces produce new policies? And the answer to that is, we don't know, because it's too early to tell. So far, we are in a very preliminary stage of establishing the atmosphere for a more direct dialogue. We haven't begun the dialogue itself.
What's next for Charles Freeman?
Well, I have the wonderful opportunity to reinvent myself I have, in preparation for this job, I severed all of my commitments and had left all of the positions that I had assumed over the previous 15 years since leaving government. And now I can go back to living a full life, and I hope making some money so that I can fully enjoy the freedom I've regained. In a sense, I haven't lost anything. I think my reputation actually has been enhanced where I care about it, and those who denigrated me have perhaps had a Pyrrhic victory they may regret, because I believe the scope of debate on the issues they have sought to keep out of debate has now been opened somewhat.
All right, thank you very much for those comments, Ambassador Charles Freeman, and thank you for your company on Face to Face.
Thank you.